Hi, everyone. I'm Terry Hutchinson. Welcome to the Interpreter Insights Podcast. My guest today is going to be Dr. John Gee, who's been on the program with me several times and who I've co-hosted with on various interpreter audio, radio podcasts for several years. Now, the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, or scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. And if you like the podcast, please tell your friends about it and subscribe. You can find it anywhere you get your regular podcasts. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. Before we get to John, I just want to remind people that normally at this time, I've been doing a survey of the various volumes of the journal. That's the publication of the weekly articles put online for free by the Interpreter Foundation. We're not going to have time for that this episode for reasons I'll get into in a future episode. But in the meantime, we want to welcome Dr. Gee to the program and have a conversation with him about a recent presentation that he gave at the Interpreter Conference on the Small Plates, as well as an article he just did in a book that's collected by BYU Studies. I asked John to come on because recently the Interpreter Foundation, as we mentioned on this program, completed a conference on the Small Plates of Nephi, and it was called For a Wise Purpose in Him, the Small Plates of Nephi Conference. It was held May 29th and 30th at BYU. You can find copies of some of the presentations on the website, and eventually I think they're going to be published in a book. I'm hopeful if it's like the last conferences that Interpreter has sponsored, it'll be out. I doubt it'll be out later this summer. The last one was early May, and the books were out in August, if I recall, the one about Abraham. Yeah. So we'll see. But in the meantime, John gave a talk called The Reality of the Small Plates. And I asked John to come on because also recently, the Religious Studies Center published a book called In the Eyes of the Ancients, Historical Perspectives on the Book of Mormon. And John has an essay in that book as well, and it's called Tablets of the Covenant. And when I was looking at the title for that one, and I looked at the title for John's presentation at the conference, which I wasn't able to attend, I thought they looked a little similar, so I thought we'd have John come on and kind of explain both of those to us and tell us exactly what you found.
Okay, well, let's start with In the Eyes of the Ancients.
Sure.
Because that's dealing with the gold plates. And it's discussing how in the ancient world, in ancient Israel and in the Hittites, metal plates, actually even into the Egyptians to some extent, metal plates are used for covenants. So one of the things that if Joseph Smith had known the stuff that we know now, he would expect that when an angel is giving him metal plates, that it should have something to do with covenants. And so that's what that paper is about, is how metal plates are used for covenants. Now, that's not something out of Joseph Smith's background. In fact, in Joseph Smith's background, the whole idea that anything was written on metal plates was assigned to them that Joseph Smith just made it up. Because nobody wrote on it. Everybody knew that Jews didn't write on metal. Nobody wrote on metal. They knew wrong. But that's so the fact that in the title page, even, it talks about that these plates are to remember the covenants of the Lord. So there's a connection between. Now, the Small Plates Conference was amazing on a number of levels. So I just want to talk about the Small Plates Conference because it has been at least 15 years since anybody has done anything like the Small Plates Conference, where you have a conference taking the Book of Mormon seriously as an ancient document. And it's hard to believe it's been 15 years since anybody's done that, but it has. And I think there's a lot of pent-up demand for this and a lot of pent-up research because the gatekeepers of who have been
who publish LDS Matters.
Yeah, we've been in charge of publishing on the Book of Mormon, haven't wanted to deal with the Book of Mormon as an ancient document. That's not important to them. Now, you know, the Book of Mormon is very important in the church, and There are lots of things that you get out of the Book of Mormon, and so you can study it in a wide variety of ways. But at the end of the day, if it didn't really happen, then there's no real point in studying it. If it isn't what it says it is, then, you know, I suppose you can go get your morals from, say, Jane Austen, which comes out, you know, about 20, 30 years earlier, but, you know, around the same time. And it's fiction, and many people like to read it, but it's not the same, because there's a reality at the Book of Mormon. And you could see that because there were just so many presentations that they had to do three at the same
time.
Yeah,
there were different sessions, so no one could go to everything.
Right. There were a few plenary papers where everybody was in one auditorium. And one of the great things about the conference, I've long thought that BYU had the ideal conference setup because they held the breakout sessions in the MARB, the Martin Building. And the Martin Building has these four lecture halls, and they're all connected.
Yeah, I have some memories of one of those
halls. And so when you want to change between one and the other, you just go across the hall. Mm-hmm. And it's ideal for a conference like this, except they only were able to use three out of the four. I think they only needed to, but it was great to see that venue used in that way. But a lot of very good papers. One of them, they got up and said, well, we'll give you the highlights. Our paper is 130 pages long.
We're going to talk about that one a little later, John.
Yeah, well, some really great research. I was only able to attend about a third of the presentations.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little less, but a lot of great work there, and I'm glad it's being published. Some of them, it was just so rapid fire and so compressed that you need to sort of think through the ramifications.
And that's why I always like the written papers better than the presentations.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's great that it was done. It was a great conference. If you look at metal plates in the ancient world, they have these monumental plates, which are large and designed to be posted and where you can have access to them and refer to them. And so you have this monumental size. And then you have these ones that are used for more temporary purposes. They tend to be less valuable materials, and they tend to be smaller. And format-wise, they're smaller. The Book of Mormon plates are sort of in between the two of them. They're a permanent record. They're not for display, but they're also more permanent. So more valuable material and slightly larger size than the temporary ones, smaller than the monumental ones. And one of the things that, and you have indications in the record that they're dealing with a physical object. So as they're writing the record, they can see how much space they have left. And that changes. So we give the writers of Omni a really hard time because they wrote so little.
But there wasn't very much left.
There wasn't very much left, and you can actually see them as being more generous. Nephi takes up 80% of the plates.
Yeah.
Jacob takes two-thirds of what's left. Enos takes up a third of what's left. And then you get to those writers in Omni, and they can see there's not much room left, and they just take a minimum amount. And rather than narrating all of the great things that the Lord has done, they're reduced to keeping the genealogy. I guess for some reason, they're not able to make more plates.
Well, they may have put it on the large plates, is right.
Well, they're not keeping the large plates.
Oh, that's right. The kings had those.
Yeah. So they may only have a line or two in there until you get to Amalekai and he says, I don't have any kids. I've only got a brother. He's gone. There's no way to get to him. So I'll just take the rest of this. Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of really interesting, worthwhile things to say.
And then he hands it off to, was it Benjamin or Mosiah?
Mosiah. Yeah. But he says, you know, these plates are full. But the format and the sizing of the plates is referred to in a lot of ways in the plates. And it seems that it affected the format of the chapters. So if we look at the Hittite gold or brass plates, they're about the size of a sheet of paper. And the Book of Mormon plates are about half that size. And so if we you can figure up the how do the math on the translation. I have that in my paper. And it looks like if you do the math, then the actual books the writers will take until you get to Jerem and Omni will take an exact number of sides of plates.
Okay.
So Enos takes up one side of one plate. You know, maybe I've got my the proportions are there, so maybe it's twice as many plates, but I wasn't thinking so. And you know, in which case Enos is taking up an entire one, but they're limiting themselves to that amount. And Jacob ends in current thing chapter six, and that would be the end of a plate, and then he adds on seven, which takes up basically a whole side for chapter seven. So that format, or that the physical reality of the plate, seems to have affected the format and the amount of writing they're putting on their plates. And the interesting thing is, if you go back and look at the Book of Mormon manuscripts and the original manuscript, none of that. Joseph Smith is not fitting chapters or books onto
Pieces of
even
paper.
number of pages.
He's just writing.
He's just writing. But it looks like the physical plates had an effect on the format and the amount that the various writers would write.
But does this also lend itself to, do we find that in other ancient sources like this, where they have metal plates, where they limit themselves physically to the amount of space that's there? Or is there not enough data or discoveries to make that
Well,
claim?
when you look at ancient manuscripts, they generally have an idea of what they're going to write, and they format the size of the what they're doing to the format. So you look at ancient letters, and they have an idea how much they're going to write. They make the tablet that size, and they fill up the tablet, and that's it. Or you get you're going to write a letter on papyrus. You have a piece of papyrus and you fit it in there. They do have some ways of making longer works and adding to, say, a papyrus scroll, and they will just add as much as they need, and then they end it. And so they will tack on. So they'll ride along, and then they'll tack on an extra sheet. So these sorts of physical constraints were very much in play in the ancient world.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question is you and I were talking beforehand about a project you're working on that you have unlimited data or pages that you can write. You're not limited in terms of what you can write by virtue of the materials available to you to write on.
Right, and that's the way it is with Joseph Smith to an extent. There's a point where they run out of paper and they have to get more, but paper is inexpensive enough that that's not a major consideration.
But in the ancient world, you have to make a tablet or you have to
Yeah,
papyrus or something. So
right, and
writing was very limited. So was it just all oral traditions that was kind of kept through this stuff?
well, there's lots of writing. We have very little of it. I sat down one time and figured out that we should have, given the length of time of Pharaonic Egypt and the sort of tax records, the regional tax summaries, we should have 250,000 of those. We have one. So they probably generated 250,000 of them, but we have
But
one.
they didn't survive.
They didn't survive. There's also the oral tradition, and yes, literacy is somewhat limited, but the literacy estimates, and I did a pointed this out at an Egyptologist, depending on what you base your estimate on, you can come up with less than 1% literacy rate. You can come up with literacy estimates at 10%, or you can actually come up with literacy estimates at 50%. And it depends on what you're basing your estimate on. So we have a wide range of what we can estimate on literacy, and it depends on the type of literacy that you're talking about. You're talking about active literacy, where you're actually writing stuff or composing stuff on a regular basis, or you're talking about passive literacy. You can read if you have to, you know, and then there's complete illiteracy, and we have these accounts that talk about how illiterate people somehow get also get access to writing. And there's lots of opportunities to get where you know the material, even if you can't read it.
Well, yeah, well, there's a so, years ago so, on my book show, I reviewed a book by a French professor called How to Talk About a Book You've Never Read, and that's close to it. And yet, when we really think about it, because of certain common elements in society, and granted, it's changing over time,
yeah.
But I mean, I found a recent translation of Les Miserables where they quote Matthew, but they have to cite it in a footnote because the majority of people today don't recognize the quote. But when Victor Hugo wrote it, of course, everyone knew what it was.
Right. And you think about it, in the ancient world, or among the ancient Christians, if you showed up for church every Sunday, they read long passages of scripture, and they'd go through a whole set of readings over the course of a year.
Uh-huh.
If you just pick somebody out of the congregation at church and ask them to recite the sacrament prayer, they'd probably be pretty close. They may not have a word for your word, but they'd be close.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who says that he's always grateful when the priest messes up the sacrament prayers, because otherwise no one would pay attention to them. But when they mess up, then you pay attention.
Yeah.
And so you do have those sorts of elements and that kind of literacy as well. People know some things. And in Nephite society, it seems like there are both types. So King Benjamin gives his speech from the tower and then has it written down and read to people who couldn't make it.
Yeah.
So we get both the orality and the writing there. In ancient Israel, they were supposed to read, as you show up for the Feast of Tabernacles, and they're supposed to read the entire Pentateuch at the Feast of Tabernacles. That would take a while.
Yeah.
Or they'd read part of it. In Iceland, they'd have the Althing once a year, and the Lögsögumaður would recite a third of the law code every year. So everybody knew what the laws were. I often think, now that would be interesting if your local congressman had to go read all the laws to you every year.
Oh, boy.
I think the length of the laws would get truncated.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the Supreme Court decisions recently was 192 pages. So between the dissents and the concurrences and everything, yeah.
And when they're releasing five a week?
We actually had 10 this week for the end of the term. But anyway, that's always an exciting day. But that's a topic for another time. So essentially, though, John, the purpose or the gleaning we can take from your presentation on the small plates is they were literal because of the way the writing conforms to the physical limitations of the plates themselves.
Yeah, they're dealing with a real physical object. It has a certain height, it has a certain width, and they're small plates because it appears like all the plates are the same size. They're the small plates because when you get down to Jerem, they don't have a lot of room left, and they're not as thick as the large plates. So the other thing I talked a little bit about there is based on some research by Stan Carmack and Royal Skousen. For a long time, I haven't been able to tell whether the original language of the Book of Mormon, we know the script is Egyptian, but is the language Egyptian or is the language Hebrew? And based on Royal Skousen and Stan Carmack's work, looking at the early modern English translation, there are certain phrases that aren't really good English and are indicative of the original language. Now, the one that everybody has talked about in the past has been the if-and construction.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the Moroni's promise was originally, and if you will read these things with the, now here I'm going to botch the quoting by memory, you know, if ye shall ask with a sincere heart, having faith, and then the originally says, and he will manifest it unto you by the power of the Holy Ghost. That's not good English. That's impossible English. That is, does show up in Hebrew, but it also shows up in Egyptian. So you can't tell. But they've discovered another feature that's in the Book of Mormon that we haven't really noticed before that is not Joseph Smith's English. It's used occasionally in early modern English, but It isn't used in Hebrew, and it is used in Egyptian.
Okay.
And
And this is in the paper,
I can't
maybe
remember if this
not?
is in the paper or not.
Or is this in
I've
one of the
been.
interpreter papers you've done on the grammar of the Book of Mormon or the
Well, no,
phraseology?
it's not in that one, but there is. I have been asked to write it up. I'm in the process, but I keep. Now that I'm looking for specific Egyptianisms, now I start looking for some of the same things and going through and saying, well, this isn't characteristic of English, but is it characteristic of Egyptian? Can I find that construction, exact construction or turn of phrase in Egyptian? And some of them, so it's taking more time because although the initial one, yes, I've got it. Are there some of these other ones out there, and do they fit? And sometimes I think I've got one and say, oh, great, I found another one. And then I dig into it and
Slips
this
away.
one probably doesn't work. So that's taking a little more time.
Well, John,
But
really quick, one of the other presentations covers a subject you've spent a lot of time on, and that's the Book of Isaiah.
yeah.
Particularly the what we call the unity of Isaiah, which is that
Yeah.
Isaiah wrote the whole thing, as opposed to modern scholarship, which tends to break it up into two and sometimes three different writers from
Right.
different periods of time.
Right. What's surprising about this when you start looking at the scholarship, and this is what's pointed out, and this is Neil Rapelye and Spencer Krauss, their paper on Isaiah. What's surprising when you start digging into it is how little they actually try to dig up evidence to support that view. Occasionally somebody does something, but for the most part, people just assume it and they don't actually try to demonstrate it. It's a weird situation because the people arguing for unity of Isaiah have a much longer tradition of that being accepted, and that's just rejected out of hand. But when you try to get reasons for it,
Yeah, honest scholars like
they don't do it. And so Rapelye and Krauss go through and look at some of the reasons that have been given, and a lot of them aren't very good.
So their work is a kind of a parallel to some things you've done, because
It
Don
is.
Perry has written on Isaiah,
Yeah.
and he's cited that you've done some important work on that that is yet to be published. We've talked about this many times over the years.
Right. Well, actually, there is a project underway to get all that published. It's in the early stages. Not all the papers have come in. Mine are in.
For sure.
So we looked through the. So the, the question is, so there are a lot of issues there that when it was originally proposed, people didn't think of. So when this idea was first put forward, nobody knew anything about the ancient Near East. The Bible was the oldest book known. Now we have literary works and other sorts of documents from 1,000 years before some of the people associated with the Bible, like Abraham, lived. So you can, it's not a lot of stuff from 1,000 years before Abraham lived, but you can find stuff that's hundreds of years before Abraham lived. And in fact, the Joseph Smith papyri have some texts that predate Abraham by a couple hundred years. Yes, it's a manuscript from the Ptolemaic period, but the text itself was written long before that. And so I always find the criticism amusing when they say, well, but these are Ptolemaic, not from the time of Abraham. It's some of the texts actually go back before Abraham.
Before that, yeah.
So
So their paper is a little more of a, is it a reception? Not, I mean, I don't want to say it's a reception history, but it was
it's
a
a look at the
tracing of.
scholarship on that attributes and some of the arguments that have been put forward for why Isaiah should be separated out, and they go through them and find a lot of them unconvincing. So I'm glad they've done that. It's a valuable contribution.
I mean, and that's just one of the ones. So I'd encourage people who are listening, go to the website, look up the conference, look for the papers, and then look for them to for the presentations to be posted on the website. And then as well, when the volume comes out, check it
Yeah.
out because it'll be really valuable. We appreciate you being with us, John, to talk about the physicality of the small plates as well as the reality of the gold plates. I think that's been very helpful for all of us. So thanks for being with us. So it's always a pleasure to be with you, John. Thank you for your time. And
thank you
we want to thank those of you who've been with us. Join us again for another episode of Interpreter Insights. This is Terry Hutchinson along with John Gee. Thanks for being with us.